It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
When we talk about political polarization, it's a rule of thumb that urban areas tend to vote more Democratic, while suburban and rural areas seem to lean Republican.
That geographic and political divide is nowhere more prevalent in the northern United States than in Wisconsin's biggest metropolitan area, Milwaukee and the surrounding counties. In fact, nowhere else in the country do two counties as big and politically far apart as Milwaukee and Waukesha counties share a border.
A special report by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, written by Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert, explores how this geographic divide between Republicans and Democrats came to be in the Milwaukee metro area and how it's grown in recent decades.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts. Do you live in southeastern Wisconsin? Have you noticed this big divide? Do you think it affects how different political sides view each other and how our government functions? Call 800-642-1234. Right now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, over the last several years, we've seen trends emerging about how partisan politics come into play in different areas of the country. What surprised you the most about how partisan politics play out in the Milwaukee area?
Well, when you cover politics in Wisconsin, you know, and you live in southeastern, anyone who lives in southeastern Wisconsin is aware of the kind of dynamics of these very, very Republican suburban counties and obviously a very Democratic urban county. But we wanted in this project to put it into a national context. And what struck me in doing the research was, A, just how kind of systematic this trend has been over time, where the red parts get redder and the blue parts get bluer and they get farther apart. And just with every election, the patterns get stronger and stronger. And the second thing is, when you look at other large metro areas around the country, Milwaukee really does jump out in a couple of ways. I mean, it's this kind of geographic polarization. Another way of putting it is the degree to which people are politically segregated in their neighborhoods, in very one-sided, kind of like-minded political neighborhoods. Milwaukee's probably the best example of that kind of outside the southern United States, and it's very stark, and it has a lot of implications for voters. It has implications for the region, and it has a lot of interesting kind of partisan implications that we'll be addressing later in the series.
And for this piece, you looked at years of data right down to the precinct. How did you arrive at this conclusion that the Milwaukee area, is one of the most politically polarized cities in the country?
Well, one thing we did was we collected decades of voting data down to the ward level in Wisconsin, which is easy to do going back a decade or so, but beyond that, you kind of have to digitize a lot of data that's available in print form. And then you map it, and then you analyze it kind of statistically. And then, unfortunately, the same level of detail is not available in a lot of other metro areas. So there are some recent elections for which you can find the same kind of data in a lot of different places. And when you look at that data, Milwaukee is ranks really highly on some of these measures. There's no one way to measure polarization, but certainly the degree to which it's politically segregated, it's really, really high. And also when you look at the county data, which is available everywhere, and you look at the distance between the Republican counties in the metro area and the Democratic county in the metro area, that gap is bigger in Milwaukee than anywhere but New Orleans among the top 50 metros.
Let's paint a picture of Milwaukee for people based on the information that you saw. Who are the people voting which way in different areas? What does it look like if you look at the neighborhoods and the suburbs?
Right.
What do you see?
Well, I would say the Democratic coalition is a little bit more is more diverse, certainly, than the Republican coalition. When you're talking about Republican voters in these suburban counties, certainly they're overwhelmingly white. I mean, one of the things that jumps out about metropolitan Milwaukee, which is very relevant to this discussion, is it's one of the most racially segregated metropolitan areas in the country. So that has big political consequences because African Americans are voting, 9-1 for Democrats, and white voters are kind of all over the map. So the suburban counties are overwhelmingly white. You have a lot of married couples. You have a lot of homeowners. You have some economic diversity. I mean, some of these very Republican communities are kind of blue collar and you know, more non-college than college-educated voters, and some of them are very upscale and affluent. On the Democratic side, you've got kind of a coalition. You've got African-American voters in the city of Milwaukee. You've got Latino voters in the city of Milwaukee. And then you've got, you know, college-educated white voters on the North Shore, which is an interesting trend in and of itself, because these North Shore inner suburbs within Milwaukee County, where very college-educated and pretty well-off communities have been trending Democratic for decades. They used to be among the most Republican places in Metro Milwaukee, and now some of them are among the most Democratic places.
And you say that because these two groups of people, people who are, you know, in the inner city or the city in general, the denser populated areas, and then the people in the surrounding areas, you know, they have diametrically different political views, but they're so close together that there seems to be this sort of us and them mindset playing out, saying the people who live in the city are like this, and then people in the inner city, in the city in general, just looking outwards and seeing something different about people who live there. What are those attitudes?
Well, it's you know, part of what's happened is a lot of the voters in the outer suburbs started out in Milwaukee County or in the city of Milwaukee, or their parents started out in the city of Milwaukee. So you had, you know, a lot of white flight in previous decades. And those voters who left the city of Milwaukee and the county of Milwaukee clearly were more conservative than the white voters that stayed behind. And in some cases, they had negative attitudes about the city. In some cases, they were just, people that were following jobs and looking for bigger houses or lower taxes or better schools. But what's interesting about this is that in a place like Milwaukee, when you just look at white voters, the white voters who are close in, who are living in the city or on the periphery of the city in more densely populated neighborhoods, tend to be more liberal and more democratic than the white voters who live farther out. And that pattern shows up in the polling data as well. It's pretty strong pattern where the farther out you go from the city of Milwaukee, the more conservative and the more Republican within the metro area those voters are.
And we have time for a couple calls here. If you live in the Milwaukee metro area, what do you think of the political divide? Do you see it playing out in your own life? Do you see attitudes there that are challenging, that represent people living in close proximity who have very different political views? How do you see that going on in where you live, if you live in southeastern Wisconsin? The number 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Craig, there has been a byproduct of these people with these, you know, opposing political views being crammed so close together there in the Milwaukee metro area, and that seems to be political engagement. What are we seeing there?
Well, another way in which southeastern Wisconsin just jumps off the charts is these almost freakish levels of turnout that we've seen. Certainly Wisconsin is a high turnout state, but when I looked at the 2012 presidential election, the highest turnout county in the country was Ozaukee County, one of our four metro Milwaukee counties, and Waukesha was tied for second. Dane County, just not very far to the west of Milwaukee, was fifth. And so you've got really, really remarkable rates of turnout and other forms of political engagement. Certainly, in the recall extravaganza, we saw massive engagement on both sides, signing recall petitions, you know, going to rallies, and so that is part of the mix here, where you have people who are activated in part by the divisions. And the fact they're active and engaged and following politics so closely also kind of feeds and fuels the divisions. And so both those things, I think, are kind of working off each other.
And general political engagement, a good thing in this case, are people in this area just canceling out each other's votes?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there is kind of a level in which, you know, both sides are just kind of maximizing their vote in some of these elections and kind of canceling each other out. But what's interesting is that, in some elections you have one side's more motivated than the other, and in some elections you have one side turning out at higher rates than the other. And where that really comes into play is in presidential elections, you've got so much of the Democratic coalition are younger voters and minority voters in the city of Milwaukee, and they turn out in presidential races, but they don't turn out as much in midterms. So the kind of calculus of which side has the bigger base shifts between the midterm election and the presidential election. That's one reason why we kind of see this oddity of the two parties. It's like feast or famine. I mean, they've basically gotten very good at winning very different kinds of elections in Wisconsin.
Well, you painted a picture of a region that's hugely divided and really close together geographically. Why is this happening in the Milwaukee area? Why is this city, this metro area, the poster child for partisan politics in America?
Well, the three things that strike me about metro Milwaukee, and we've talked about some of them. One is racial segregation, which creates not only this sort of big demographic differences and the way voters are clustered together, but also there's obviously racial divisions in southeastern Wisconsin that also feed the political division. So that's one thing. But then you add in these sort of two political factors, which is one is the kind of culture of engagement that we've talked about, which is kind of a Wisconsin thing, and it's especially pronounced in southeastern Wisconsin, and that has an effect. And then the competitiveness of the state and the competitiveness of the region makes it a magnet for a lot of political activity. So you get every 2 years, the parties come in, they mobilize their voters, there's all this election activity, advertising, get out the vote. That raises the political temperature, and that also tends to kind of amplify these divisions. So I would say it's kind of the demographics of the area combined with the kind of a unique or interesting set of political attributes that you don't find in too many other metro areas.
Craig, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His new report shows that the Milwaukee region is one of the country's most geographically divided metropolitan areas between Republicans in the suburbs and Democrats in the city.
40 hours a week in a cube is standard today for the huge numbers of people who go to work every day in an office. But as commonplace as the office seems, it's got a long history, from the counting houses of the 19th century to the steno pools of the 60s. Pop culture has gotten in on the act, too, like the movie Office Space.
I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay. Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too, okay?
Well, our next guest takes up the story of The Office in his new book. Nikhil Saval joins us now. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write that the United States is a nation of clerks. How many of us work in offices today?
Well, it's actually kind of a difficult thing to estimate because things are changing so quickly. People who used to work in offices now work from home or work in cafes or, all over the place. I think I can say that about 60% of the people who do work in offices work in cubicles, but it's changing very rapidly. And so the number percentages are all over the place.
Well, yeah, as you say, now working in an office probably means working in a cubicle farm. But let's look at their ancestors. What were the first clerks like?
Well, the first clerks, I really locate the kind of origins of the office in the mid-19th century. And the first clerks were curious creatures in America. I think people really were wary of office work at the time. It was both new and growing and yet also not how people thought of work. They thought of work as farming or factory work, whereas clerks didn't seem to produce anything. They just reproduced. They made paperwork. And they were often physically thinner than most people. They were pale. Walt Whitman referred to them as a sort of round-shouldered generation of narrow chest. He called them forked radishes. They were just so pale and thin. And, you know, so people were very scared in a way of what clerks represented about the future of work.
And one thing that represented was a switch from manual labor to, you know, working with your body, which seemed wholesome out in the sunshine, to working inside in the dark, musty places where your muscles weren't exercised. How did that play out?
Well, you know, it was a strange shift. I mean, I think the U.S., while it didn't really, you know, most economies just didn't care so much about administration, about bureaucracy, about accounting. But as business grew bigger, especially after the Civil War, business became big business. It suddenly became necessary, or considered necessary, to administer this work and to keep accounts and just know where your money was going. And so for those purposes, they needed clerks, and they started to build large offices, which, in fact, they actually modeled after factories. I mean, the original offices resemble factories. People probably know the images of row after row of desks in a steno pool or an accounting pool, people clocking in and out, as in, you know, the film The Apartment or the film Mad Men sort of represents this as well. So that in a way, the office, though it was supposed to represent a kind of escape from manual labor, in a way resembled it in broad outline.
And it didn't look fun.
No, it was never really considered fun, as much as it was considered prestigious. And there was something about it that was, you know, had high status. The office work has often been considered a middle class occupation. You was clean, you wore the same work clothes to work as you wore outside it. You didn't come home smelling of your job. At the same time, you know, at certain points, your income might even be lower than a blue-collar worker's. The work might just be drudgery. It might not be that exciting. So as much as it was supposed to be mental labor and knowledge work, it was not, did not often feel that way to the people doing it.
Well, moving ahead a little bit, around this time, you write about Frederick Taylor. Used time management to revolutionize how factories worked. I didn't know that he also changed how offices worked. How did he put his stamp on the office of today?
Well, one of the major influences of Taylor on the office was the fact that he effectively created the science of management, or he certainly made it popular. What he did is before in factories, people, there was a sort of loose level of control by workers over the work they did. I mean, they didn't control their factories, but they could have some measure of control over the process. And Taylor hated this. He thought that there could be more efficient ways to do this, more knowledgeable ways. And so his goal in life effectively was to transfer the knowledge of the work process to a group of managers who effectively operated out of an office. I mean, they would monitor the work, and they would change it. They would streamline it. They would divide it within an inch of its length. And they controlled the process. So he separated the execution of work from the knowledge of how it worked. So in a way, he created a kind of managerial class. In turn, his acolytes started to rationalize that class. So he had an acolyte, William Leffingwell, who was obsessed with the office and thought offices could become more efficient. He measured how long it took you to get to the water fountain, and would calculate the fact that if you walked 10 feet every day, it would add up to miles in a day, in a year, that you walked to and from a water fountain. So you would rationalize every aspect of the efficiency of the office to make envelope licking more efficient, things like filing more efficient, things like that. So it, in a way, Taylor and his acolytes helped give birth to the big office bureaucracies of the 20th century.
So did he basically make office life more miserable for subsequent office workers, or were there, you know, some profound good things that came out of what he did?
Well, in a way, I mean, he did, you know, there were some gains in efficiency. There were some ways in which the division of labor was made more natural, made things work more smoothly. On the other hand, he definitely was out to break the control of workers over work. And so lots of people since Taylor have positioned themselves against him. They tried to moderate Taylor's influence. The whole concept of human resources, of personnel management, of psychology, this was in a way to counter the fact that Taylor wasn't well liked by workers. And certainly in offices, it was too brutal a tactic. So the workplace tried to use much more psychological methods after Taylor to make people happier.
We're talking to Nikhil Saval, an editor at N+1, and the author of the new book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
Coming up after the news, we'll get into the more modern office, and that's where you come in. We want to hear from you. Do you spend your days in an office? According to some studies, 93% of people who work in cubicles say they don't like it. They'd want to work anywhere else. What do you think about that? What would you think of a future where we didn't have to put in time at work, at the office? We could work anywhere, anytime, free-range people. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Hope to hear from you coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
People say, I am the best boss. They go, God, we've never worked in a place like this before. You're hilarious. And you get the best out of us. I think that pretty much sums it up.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. That was a clip of boss extraordinaire Michael Scott from The Office. We're talking about office work right now and bosses and cubicles and where it all came from with Nikhil Saval. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
And we'd love your take on office culture. 93% of people who work in cubicles say they don't like it. What about you? Is your office work experience pretty good and pretty positive, or is it kind of like The Office or Office Space or the Dilbert comic strips? If you could change anything about office work, what would it be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, we listened to a clip from The Office there, and it's sort of this absurdist, depressing, you know, view of the office. But there is sort of this cloud of boredom and angst that hangs over the stereotypical idea of what working in an office is like. Where did that, you know, that feeling and that the idea of offices being like that, where did that come from?
Well, it's I wish I could say that it's new or that it could might go away, but in a way, it seems to adhere to even the earliest descriptions of the office. People probably know Bartleby, the Scrivener, the Melville story, which is all about doing copying documents endlessly, and the boredom that induces, all the way, of course, to the present, to things like The Office or Office Space. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, I mean, there's this sort of central contradiction at the heart of The Office, and one is that it's a place that's about merit, you know, and about individualism, that you as an individual can start at the bottom and rise to the top of your company. So it's really up to you. In a way, it's about striving. And so that should create a certain kind of competition, a certain kind of excitement. On the other hand, there's so much that you don't control about that. In a way, there's exploitation in offices. There's domination. There's petty grievances, simmering resentments, politics. And all of this stuff can intervene to make it seem like it's not in your control, and it's like a collective experience of a certain kind of, you know, powerlessness. And this is what most films and TV shows and novels about the office depict. I think that's what they're trying to get at in Office Space or The Office, the fact that you know, it's very sociable, but it's also that sociability is also the sort of thing that is kind of covering up for the fact that you may not be able to control your work as much as you like.
Let's get into the cubicle concept itself. I think a lot of us show up to work at an office and, you know, the layout is just what the layout is. But as you point out in your book, these things come from somewhere. Somebody thought of them. What's the origin of the cubicle?
The cubicle is one of the great ironies, I think, of the office. It was invented by an autodidact designer, Robert Probst, who was hired by the Herman Miller Company in the 50s. And, you know, the office he confronted was, you know, another kind of rote gesture of an office, just desks in the center, offices around the side, and people got the offices once they had achieved a certain level of status in the office. And he wanted to free office workers from this setup. He thought that it was not conducive to how people actually worked, which was correct. And so he, over time, kind of worked up this idea based on his own research, on surveys and things like that, and realized that office wanted their own space, but it had to be flexible because he thought the change was constant in the office, computerization, things like that. So in 1968, he unveiled this system called Action Office 2. Probst really thought offices were about movement, about old, you know, it was like a very dynamic, flexible space. It was three walls. It was meant to be obtusely angled. You could change it if you liked. And, you know, it was meant to be individualized. And what happened is the Action Office got copied by many furniture companies. And as it got copied, it started to turn into a box because managers realized that it was very efficient for cramming as many people into as little space as quickly as possible with as little cost as possible. And that was sort of when the Action Office became a cube. It sort of became a symbol at that point of an arbitrary, callous workplace. Even though they could, at the early on, they could say, look, you have some private space. But I think that feature has been lost.
And
over time.
People really seem to hate their cubicles from some of the statistics you report. Douglas Kuplan called them veal fattening pens. And you even start your book talking about a viral video of cubicle rage where someone completely freaks out in an office and starts throwing papers and clubbing their printer or whatever else he did. What happened there that spoke to so many people?
Well, you know, it's the cubicle itself. I mean, it is sort of, as a design concept, not very good. It doesn't provide a lot of privacy. It doesn't shield noise, but it's not really the problem. I think things started to change, especially in around the late 80s and the 90s, when the workplace itself just more generally became transfigured by changes in the economy, deregulation, the decline of the labor movement more broadly, and the rise of mergers and acquisitions and layoffs that accompanied that. And so the cubicle became this symbol of this of the transience and precariousness of the workplace, and so things like Gilbert really take off in the 90s, and Office Space comes out in the late 90s. It's, so in a way, it was not that the thing is bad to sit in, although it often very very much is, but that it is sort of like a very efficient connotation of everything that's wrong with the way we work and the sort of sense of that the workplace. That work is really corroded in a certain way.
And going along with that trend toward reacting against the cubicle, you see a rise, especially in, you know, Silicon Valley type environments and media coverage of those, of a revolution and changing the workplace and what it looks like. What kind of experiments have we seen?
Well, in a way, there's a real attempt to make the workplace enchanted or justifiable or legitimate in a way I think that had been lost certainly by the 90s with things like that Office Space, I think, reveals that. And what you see is a lot of attempts like to make these workplaces sort of like universities, I think. They're campuses, they're self-contained. Places like Google or Facebook, a lot of the Silicon Valley campuses have amenities and food and sometimes bowling alleys, resistance pools, volleyball courts, gyms, you know, things to keep you there, to basically fulfill life needs and needs for leisure and things like that just at work, so you don't really have to leave. I think that's one of the major trends that you see to make work seem like it's, you know, that it's better, or at least make it more palatable.
And yet, you know, it doesn't always work, these upgrades that we think will be so much better than the cubicle. You tell a story in your book about an agency that went from having desks and all the usual trappings of the office to having lockers and tilt-a-whirl, those little spinny things from the amusement park. And people were supposed to meet in those. And there were only a certain number of computers and phones. And it doesn't sound like it went so great.
No, this was the sort of infamous experiment of the offices of Chiat Day, the advertising agency in the 90s. And the thing that there were many things wrong with the concept, but I think the kind of fundamental issue is that this concept was conceived and designed over the heads of the people who actually had to work in the office. And so then it was imposed on them as this visionary idea, in a way not unlike the cubicle or many experiments in the office. And so it had no relationship to how people actually needed to work or what they had to do in a given day. So they found themselves tossed into this maelstrom, basically, of work where, you know, they didn't have enough phones, people didn't know where to take calls, it was just like a mess. And situations like this persist to this day. I mean, the technology is better, but what you see over and over are plans like this in some ways being imposed on workers without real input from workers themselves. And I think that's one of the recurring mistakes.
Is there something inherent in office work that no matter how you lay out the office and how you structure the desks or cubicles or whatever, it's going to be kind of boring for the workers no matter what?
Well, I think that it would be a mistake to lay too much emphasis on design itself as a panacea or a solution to things that people don't like about work. I mean, really what you see in design is a tendency to kind of solve the problems of work, but actually design can only really accommodate work or hinder it in a certain way, and sometimes make it worse, like open office plans are often bad for concentration, for example, things like that. I think to look for solutions to how we work, you really have to look to the levels of autonomy and independence on the part of the workers themselves. A lot of that comes from organization. You see in Europe in the 1970s, they rejected things like open office plans and cubicles, partly because they were organized in office. And there was traditions of social democracy and solidarity that meant that they could control, to some degree at least, how their offices look and how their work was divided. I think that's the sort of thing that we have to look at in the United States if we want to see changes to really salubrious, helpful changes to the way we work.
Nikhil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Nikhil Saval, editor at N+1 and the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
We want to hear from Wisconsinites who aren't that into sports. Here in Wisconsin, we have the Packers, the Badgers, the Brewers, and those teams are all hugely popular. But we know there are people out there who just don't care about sports. If that's you, or if you're in a family or circle of friends where you have the sports lovers and the sports meh, share your experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org.
To kick off this segment, we have a Wisconsin Life piece from a non-sporty person. In it, Joe Schaefer tells us about his many ill-fated attempts to get into the game.
Dairy aside, Wisconsin loves sports more than anything. We measure time in sports seasons, not months. Once in middle school, I arrived in class to find a student weeping, head down on his desk. The Packers had lost. I tried to comfort him, but wasn't very good at it, knowing nothing about football. Sometimes, I feel like I'm one of the only people in the state born without the sports gene. Unfortunately, the same goes for playing sports. I'm a natural-born pacifist and don't see the point in conquering a group of fellow citizens on a field or mat. But in Wisconsin, kids are supposed to be athletes. My parents desperately wanted me to fit in, even though they have little interest in athletics themselves. That's how I found myself sitting in a car at age 6. I'd been given a shirt emblazoned with the word Strikers in bold orange type. What was a striker? I soon found out. I was. My parents stopped the car by a small field. There stood dozens of kids. From the looks of their t-shirts, I could see they were also strikers. Apparently, we were a soccer team. Needless to say, I didn't fit in. But my parents couldn't accept the idea that I'd be a sports outcast, so they tried every other option they could think of. There was fencing, in which I was encased in a helmet twice the size of my head. I made a brief appearance at wrestling camp, but couldn't last more than a few seconds in a match. My low point was gymnastics. I had to be carried out of the gym. There was only one sport left to try, football. I was in 5th grade, which is apparently not too young to be strapped into pads, shoved onto the field, and told to show no mercy. I soon learned that football parents really want their kids to win. A teammate's dad stopped me on the sidelines and pounded my chest. Go Regents, he screamed. Go Regents, I tried to shout back, my prepubescent voice cracking. I spotted my parents in the stands. They weren't screaming about the Regents. In fact, they weren't paying much attention at all. My dad had brought a book about Benjamin Franklin. I fantasized about reading a book myself, but the coach blew his whistle. Hey, you! Schaefer! You're in! I took my place on the defensive line and gazed up at the guy squared off against me. He was a hulking monster, at least a foot taller than me. I ventured a peace offering. Hey, good game, as long as we have fun, right? We wouldn't take an insignificant game in Sun Prairie so seriously as to do each other real harm. Then he charged. I came to a few hours later.
Joe Schaefer is a high school student in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Tune into Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Mondays at 8. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Now we want to hear from you. Does that sound like your story when it comes to participating in sports at any age? Or do you have trouble getting along in life if you are not a sports fan? Or do you negotiate this within your family between the fans and the non-fans, the participants and non-participants? Call in at 800-642-1234. Call in right now, 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@wpr.org. Matthew in Jackson will start us off. Matthew, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. How are you, Rob?
Good. Are you a sports guy?
Well, no, not really in this country. I've been living here in Wisconsin for 7 years, and I can't for the life of me understand American football.
And does that make it hard to fit in, say, at gatherings, at work, that sort of thing?
Yes, it does. Very much so. You know, people are talking about the various players on the teams, and I say, who? And just the fact that you guys, the football players here, they wear so much padding and stuff like that in comparison to the football players in Australia who don't wear any padding. It's like, yeah, it's just a very different game.
Do you try to explain real football, Australian rules football, to us here in Wisconsin?
I do indeed, and I get the same sort of looks back when I say that I don't understand American football.
All right. Matthew, thanks so much for calling in. You can join in with your sports experiences, 800-642-1234.
That's 800-642-1234. Do you ever fake it when you're in the middle of a sports conversation? Pretend that you know what's happening? Pretend that you care because you feel like you have to? Do you ever feel like sports in Wisconsin sort of amounts to a de facto secular religion? And how do you feel about that? Is it possible to just skate by not caring, or do you have to, you know, make some compromises here? In Wisconsin, we've got the Packers and the Brewers and the Badgers, lots of sports going on. And why do you think people in Wisconsin love sports so much? 800-642-1234.
And if you're a parent, do you push your kids into sports, whether they want it or not, thinking it'll help them fit in some way or another? 800-642-1234 is the number. Reminds me of a bit from the IT crowd. I should have pulled it, where the non-sports computer guys, computer nerds, I think they'd self-describe, subscribe to a service where they get the latest soccer or football banter, where they can hold up their end of a conversation just by prepping with their crib sheets the day after a game.
That's one way to go.
A huge disgrace last night, wasn't it? It's always the opening line, and whoever they're talking to can always pick it up and run with it.
Well, and we are going to go to another caller. Here we have Flora on the line from Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Flora.
Hello there. I think that genetically I'm supposed to be a sports fan. My parents had TVs going, radios going, separate games going in both rooms. My daughter and my son are crazy about sports. My husband and I, my kids tease us, we wouldn't even know which shape the ball was in the game. So I don't quite understand this sports thing. I went to all my kids' sports events, but truly didn't understand what they were doing. And when my daughter was an all-star, it totally confused me because I didn't even know what she had done to achieve it. But, you know, I don't understand sports.
Did you fake it, Flora?
I'll leave it there.
Did you let your ignorance fly, Flora?
Did I let my ignorance fly? No. I always joked about the fact that my parents had whipped the sports out of me. I just didn't care. I was so fed up with sports by the time I grew up that I swore I wasn't going to have him in my house, but it didn't work. I had him anyway.
You had him anyway, including an all-star player. Well, Flora, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're not a sports fan, does it make it hard to fit in here in Wisconsin? If you are a sports fan, do you have those people that it's hard to socialize with at a family gathering? You name it. 800-642-1234. We have Thomas on the line now in Racine. Thomas, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't have much chance to practice or play sports outside of school. And my dad was elderly, and he couldn't really introduce me to any sports. And so at school, it was really hard. I was uncoordinated on top of all that. And there was at school, there was a tremendous emphasis on baseball. And softball, and both those require enormous amount of coordination and skill. That's a big part of the game, and I just didn't have it. So it was very difficult on me, and it was very unpleasant. And when I went off to college, I went to UW-Oshkosh, and at the time, I didn't know anything about football, and in the Fox Valley, the Packers is almost a religion, you know. And now that I'm older, I enjoy football. I enjoy watching it on Thanksgiving and whatnot. I enjoy the Packers, but at the time, I was just totally ambivalent to what the hell people were so religious about.
Gotcha. Thomas, I want to give time to one more caller before we're out of time.
And let's go quickly to Ben in La Crosse. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was tough growing up, like when I was in high school, because my stepdad was not very good at competitive sports growing up, and I was, I suppose, a naturally talented player. And so I always wanted to play, and he kind of blocked me from doing that. And I noticed when I was in high school that it really did kind of, you know, stunt my growth from making friends that I would have made had I been actually in the sports themselves.
All right. Well, Ben, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And everybody, thank you for your stories as we talked about sports in Wisconsin or not being into sports in Wisconsin. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.
I wasn't a sports guy in high school. My solution ended up being marching band. Were you on a team? In high school?
I did one unlikely, completely surreal, bizarre season of softball.
Wow.
Which
okay.
No one ever believes me when I tell them. It's true.
I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.